This is Disability Beat, a public affairs program for and about people with disabilities. It's about social justice, community supports, inclusion, accessibility, freedom, and choice. My name is Vicki Nicewander, and I'm the host of this program and also the parent of a fantastic young woman with a disability.
The views and opinions expressed here are those of the speakers and do not necessarily represent those of WEFT, its board of directors, associate station manager, or Prairie Air Incorporated.
Stay tuned for an interview with Jennifer Natalia Fink, author of the book All Our Families, Disability Lineage and the Future of Kinship. But first, disability news for the week of April 18th, 2022. According to the most recent newsletter by Ed McManus of McManus Consulting, the recently retired chief of security at Choate Developmental Center in Anna, Illinois, has published a book highly critical of the Illinois DHS Office of Inspector General, saying that it has failed repeatedly in the mission to protect people with disabilities from severe abuse and neglect. One chapter of the book focuses on Choate and says the institution has a, quote, systemic environment of abuse, end quote. Barry Smoot, who retired last year after spending 2 years at Choate, said workers who were abusers threatened and intimidated other staff from reporting abuse, that suspicious injuries of nonverbal patients were not always reported, and that staff often bribed or threatened patients to recant allegations of abuse. According to Smoot, quote, there were several things that showed that I was trying to rectify that concerned me. When I presented these concerns, they were often met with resistance and disinterest. I was even labeled as overzealous in my concern for patient safety. How can you be too concerned for the safety of vulnerable populations? Smoot's book is titled Failure to Protect: How a Government Agency Ignored the Abuse of Physically and Developmentally Challenged Individuals. The risk of developing Alzheimer's disease is over 90% for people with Down syndrome, according to advocates. So when the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services, or CMS, proposed a plan for coverage of Aduhelm, a controversial new Alzheimer's drug, advocates were disturbed that people with Down syndrome would not be covered. Aduhelm was approved by the Food and Drug Administration last year, despite questions from many experts about how effective it truly is. However, CMS makes its own coverage decisions, and since most people with Down syndrome are covered by Medicare or Medicaid, the agency's determination is significant. Under a proposal released in January, CMS planned to make Aduhelm available to people with Medicare only if they were participating in clinical trials. But people with Down syndrome and any other conditions that may significantly contribute to cognitive decline would be excluded from those trials, according to the CMS proposal. According to Heather Sachs, Policy and Advocacy Director at the National Down Syndrome Congress, quote, this would mean that anyone with Down syndrome and Alzheimer's who, in consultation with their medical and support teams, wanted to try this very expensive drug as a treatment option would not have their costs covered by Medicare because they were not allowed to be part of the clinical trials, end quote. The Down syndrome community submitted more than 1,800 comments criticizing the proposal for explicitly excluding people with intellectual and developmental disabilities. Not only would the policy prevent people with Down syndrome from accessing the drug, but without clinical trial data on people with Down syndrome, advocates feared that doctors would lack important information to guide their treatment decisions. Now the agency is changing course. In its final determination issued earlier this month, CMS removed the exclusion for people with Down syndrome. Quote, their new proposal based on public comment reads, we are not finalizing the patient exclusion criteria to allow appropriate access to patient subpopulations that may need treatment based on ongoing research, end quote. This new addition to the policy doesn't guarantee access to the drug, but allows individuals with Down syndrome the opportunity to participate in clinical trials. Advocates, however, say that drug companies have been reluctant to include people with Down syndrome in their trials. According to a joint statement from several advocacy groups, quote, "We are one step closer to our goal of making sure adults with Down syndrome have equitable access to treatment options for Alzheimer's disease," end quote. "The next phase of our collective advocacy must be focused on supporting the inclusion of people with Down syndrome in clinical trials for Alzheimer's treatments." And finally, the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, again, said that it would make available over $110 million to expand Money Follows the Person, a federal program assisting people with disabilities to leave institutions. The Medicaid program gives states funds to provide employment, housing, and other services to help people transition from nursing homes and other institutions to homes in their communities. More than 20 states and territories that are not currently participating in Money Follows the Person can qualify for up to $5 million each to get the program up and running in their areas, according to officials. Said Secretary of Health and Human Services Xavier Becerra, quote, "Everyone deserves the opportunity to live at home in their communities and with their loved ones. This funding will bring dignity and peace of mind to even more seniors and people with disabilities across the country. We will continue expanding these programs to ensure all Americans have equitable access to the high-quality health care they deserve, no matter where they live," end quote. Since being authorized in 2005, Medicaid officials say they provided states with over $4 billion to help people transition out of institutions through that program. However, after Money Follows the Person officially expired in 2016, the program was in limbo for years as Congress passed 8 short-term extensions, including one as brief as 7 days. The delays took their tolls as many states halted transitions and closed their programs as money ran dry. Finally, in late 2020, the program was renewed for 3 years. Between 2008 and 2020, Money Follows the Person helped more than 107,000 people leave institutions for community-based settings, according to CMS. State Medicaid programs that are not already participating in Money Follows the Person have until May 31st to apply for the new funds. For states that are already part of the program, Medicaid officials say they will now cover all costs for what are known as supplemental services, and that category will be expanded to include additional supports to help people pick up a portion of the cost for supplemental services. And that's the news for this week. You can go your own way. And you are tuned to WEFT Champaign 90.1 FM. This is Disability Beat. I'm Vicki Nicewander, and I'm happy to be joined today by Jennifer Natalia Fink, who is the author of a brand new book that just came out last month. It's called All Our Families, Disability Lineage and the Future of Kinship. Really interesting title, really interesting book. Jennifer is a professor of English at Georgetown University, and we'll welcome her to tell us a little bit more about herself. Welcome to the program, Jennifer.
Thank you so much, Vicki. I'm really happy to be here to talk about the book.
Yeah, well, why don't you give people a little bit more information about yourself, and then we'll dig into what the book is, the important points of the book, for sure.
Great, sure. As you said, I am a professor of English at Georgetown University and also the director of the program in disability studies. And perhaps most importantly, I'm the parent of now 15-year-old girl who is a non-speaking autistic. And that has been sort of the transformational experience that led me to rethink my own disability lineage and kind of the family myths that were told about, this told and not told about disability in my family and how they shaped my understanding of disability and my daughter.
Yeah, my daughter is 38 now. So we've been on that road for a long, long while, but I'm really interested in getting your perspective on this. So why did you write this book? What is the goal?
Yeah, I think the goal is to help everybody think differently about their own families. That's why, hence all our families, right, in the title.
Sure.
That every family story is a disability story if we so choose to tell it. And to think about disability as having a lineage, as have always been there in our family stories, hidden, repressed, sometimes pathologized, and imagine what it would mean to think of disability as a normal part of our family story. I think that's fundamental to normalizing and depathologizing the experience of having a disability and being a parent or a sibling or family member to somebody with a disability.
Yeah, and I think that there are more people out there than we know who have family members that maybe they're not even aware of that have
Absolutely.
Disability.
Absolutely. And, you know, I elaborate this in the book. This kind of functions two ways. There are the family members whose stories are either not told or sort of whispered about, you know, ghosting kind of the family narrative. In my family's case, I had a cousin, quote unquote, given away at birth, who had Down syndrome, and that was a very sort of traumatic narrative that was half told, ghosting my family. And it turned out there was another second cousin who also had Down syndrome in my family, who I didn't even know about. That's how delineated and cut out she was from the story, who had a very different trajectory, was included in her family, and her family didn't, quote, give her away or institutionalize her. They, in fact, founded a very progressive institution so that she could have a Jewish life as an adult, but she grew up in her family. So those two stories illustrate how, you know, some stories are literally eradicated and some are, you know, half told, not fully articulated, rendered traumatic, right? And then the other piece of it that I get to later in the book is there are people in our families who have disabilities who we don't acknowledge are disabled. I talk about my grandmother, who really my whole life was severely hard of hearing and in her later years was deaf, and my own mother, who in her later years has become increasingly hard of hearing, and how that wasn't acknowledged as important or a part of their identities, right? Yeah. It was shameful and stigmatized. So, and they never had any community. And, you know, my grandmother kind of was very isolated by her disability, but it wasn't acknowledged as the reason she was so isolated. And my mother was much more sort of the outgoing, overcoming type. But in both cases, it couldn't really be spoken that this was a disability. So I think that it works two ways. There's the literal delineation, right? People who are cut out of the story, right? And then there are also just the naming and claiming of those who are, you know, right across the table from us, but we're not going to call it a disability. And I think that's especially true now with mental disabilities. There's still a lot of shame and stigma. And you can't find a community and identity if you can't even name and claim it, right? So those are just two dimensions of how this delineation works.
Yeah, I agree with that completely. And you never know when you're talking to any particular person in the community where they're coming from.
Yeah.
If you're going to have that discussion on disability, it comes that kind of, dismissive thing comes from families, and it comes from people who have no experience with disabilities, and it comes from people who are very well educated about disability as professionals and, you know, others. I think of doctors in particular, who some of the messages that I've heard families get from doctors has just been shameful.
Oh, it's terrible. And, you know, something I talk about in the book is, you know, we went to a million doctors, and nobody said, this is an identity. You need to find other families, other kids with similar disabilities so that your child and you have a community, right? Nobody said that. Nobody said, find adults who are non-speaking autistic so that you're not afraid of your child becoming an adult. But you see, you can learn a lot. They have a lot of wisdom, right? No, you know, it was just this individualized trauma, catastrophe, crisis, right? And I think if we had a sense of disability being part of our lineage, this trauma response would be ameliorated. That I think is so harmful. So that's to understand this as an identity with a history, culture, lineage, I think is crucial. And understanding the sort of horrific parts of some of those histories, too, you know, so that we can do better is important as well.
Absolutely. I've had people say to me, well, I'm, you know, especially when my daughter was young, oh, I'm so sorry.
Right.
She was born with this horrible disability. And I said, well, you know, she could have grown up into an axe murderer, I suppose. So I count my blessings there, right?
Right. Yeah. This is the amazingly horrible things people will say to you. It's just unbelievable. But that's the narrative in the culture. And I think, to undo that ableism, families really have to stop manufacturing it, I think. And if we can name and claim our disability lineage, we can do better for our kids and ourselves, ultimately, since if we all live so long, we'll all be disabled.
Very good point.
And there are a lot of pieces of that. You know, I'm not a public policy person. I always am careful to say that. But we have terrible care systems that are just incredibly racist and sexist in this country. And, you know, there are lots of ideas about how to fix that. It's all fixable. But we're not of a mind to fix it because we're so phobic, we're so ableist, we can't even name and claim the problem in the first place. Right. You can't really fix something that you're afraid to talk about and name, right? And that you want to perpetuate this myth that disability is rare, that disability is this thing that happens to other people, you know, and that it's an individual medical problem to be solved as opposed to a culture and identity to be proud of, but that does require care. So that's the other piece of it. And I get into the book about sort of the racist and misogynistic history of how we think about care in this country and how by claiming disability lineage, we could actually do the underlying sort of psychological work so that we could come up with better solutions.
So how do parents, how do families educate the people around them to help them to understand that ableism is wrong and does damage to people?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I don't have all the answers to that, but I do think that the first thing is to work on two fronts. One is to really find community with other disabled people and learn from the disability justice movement to understand. No doctor said there's a whole disability rights and disability justice movement that you can now be a part of, right? And I think that's fundamental to actually being a part of a larger conversation, even in your everyday life, of people you encounter who say crazy things, right? Because you can't do it alone. You need to be part to see your own individual experience in a larger context, to have the language and identity and empowerment. So I think that's actually crucial. That's something that nobody says, that I say to every family, is you need to find your people, actually. And then I think, you know, inclusion, there's a lot of energy towards inclusion, and, you know, some disability justice people don't even like that term. I'm less picky about that. You know, I don't think it's only about accessibility. I think, you know, being included is, there's no way around that if you want to be in society. But I think challenging the terms of that inclusion, right? Challenging the terms that marginalize or presume incompetence, or, you know, decide who you and your child are before they even know you, right? So I think there's sort of two fronts in this. One is really embracing the identity, community, and discourse, in a way, of the disability justice and disability rights movements, seeing yourself in those movements, giving your child the tools of self-advocacy, mm-hmm. presuming competence. And then I think there's something about being very out, and something, you know, there's sort of two fronts on that, I think. One is destigmatizing through language, right, and presence, your child's disability, but also not letting people collapse everything down to their disability, right? I talk a lot, not as sort of in super crypt fashion, hopefully, but I talk about ordinary things my child does that are particular to her,
mm-hmm.
ordinary interests she has, or interests she has that are typical of girls her age, right? So I think that particularity is important. And it's sort of this dual motion of, at the same time that we're destigmatizing, you know, I say my daughter is autistic. She's a non-speaking artistic. Not being afraid of those words,
mm-hmm.
those terms. And at the same time, everything about her can't be collapsed down into that.
Right. She is non-speaking autistic, and she can do this, and she can be
right.
this person. Yeah.
Right. So it's like the right to, instead of the super crip, like, you know, my daughter is a really good writer, which surprises people. I say non-speaking doesn't mean non-verbal, right? Mm-hmm. But to say, even if she weren't a great writer, who cares? Like, she gets to be ordinary. She gets to be ordinary. And I think that's like the right to be ordinary is a really underrated right. So I think that's a really important part of like how we talk about our kids, is talking about their disabilities like openly, directly. And what I find, I was very out about my daughter's diagnosis. And, you know, I'm a professor at Georgetown. I can't count how many professors shared their child's disability with me and nobody else. They were completely closeted about it in their professional life. Mm-hmm. I was the only person they told. So, you know, that was a little eye-opening, that so many people had children with disabilities, but they were so closeted about it, which, it's a vicious cycle. It made them feel like they were the only person.
I knew
I wasn't, because I was talking about it all the time. And people were
exactly. I know you wrote about in your book, Michael Berube, who is a former, yeah. he was a professor here at the University of Illinois. And
right.
I got to know him and his family, his son, Jamie, when Jamie was born, because we were all part of the same Down syndrome network here in the area. But, you know, he has a really interesting perspective and really talks about, and I think you quoted this in your book about him, you know, it being a ongoing lifelong learning experience, being the parent
yeah.
of a son with a disability.
Yeah, you know, and I really respect Michael Berube's work. You know, I will say that the men who write about this, the fathers, who are all great dads, 2-1, and seem to be feminists, 2-1, they tend to not write that much about the care work that their child requires.
That's true.
The lifelong care work, right? And they're stories are viewed by the press, I don't blame them for this, but as noteworthy because it's just the larger sexist structure that when fathers parent their geniuses and doing something amazing, even if it's a typically developing child, and oh my God, they must be heroes if they're parenting their non-typically developing child, right? And the real care labor and the crisis of care labor and the deprofessionalization of women that happens, and how that feeds ableism. Women are terrified of having disabled children because they know they're the people who are going to do 100% of the care work. And that's not addressed by Barrowbay, and it's not addressed by any of the men who write about this. Mm-hmm. All of whom are great guys, right? So this isn't about individual men being terrible people or anything like that. But there's a blind, there's a failure to look systemically at how racism and misogyny structure every aspect of ableism.
One thing I don't know that you got to in your book, and I just wanted to ask your perspective on this, and that is, one of the concerns of families, especially of older adults, is, I can help my adult child have a good life, but how do I sustain that after I'm gone?
Right.
The system won't do it. So
Yep. And we all, this is one of the fears that fuels ableism and then is a real fear because of the poor care system. So, I think this is something that is beginning to change with the movement towards self-directed care. And communities like Main Street, which I do talk about in the book a little bit, which is right here in Rockville, right in the suburb, right next to mine, in Maryland, which are basically providing care, including for high needs, disabled adults, in communities that are mixed residences. So they're like apartment buildings that have both disabled and non-disabled people in them, and the disabled people have the support. The idea is the parents are setting this up before they pass, right? For two reasons, so that their child can have maximum autonomy and independence, but also community with other disabled people, with the support needs that they have, that they can get in their own apartment, right? Mm-hmm. So I think that's the direction things are moving in. I don't think it's happened on a mass scale, which it needs to, right? But that's the direction that seems to work really well for everybody. Give adults with disabilities both the support and care they need in a self-directed way as much as possible. Give them community with other disabled people, as well as integration into the larger community. So that, I think, to me, that seems like one of the better models. And so I think that's kind of the direction that we're moving towards. Mm-hmm. But it costs money, right?
Oh, yeah.
It costs money and political will. And if you can't even, if you're so phobic and ableist that you can't even address this or imagine that adults with disabilities have something to contribute to a community, right? Have lives that can be very fulfilling, right? If this is just this bogeyman you're afraid of, then we're not going to create on a mass scale these communities. But that's what I've seen.
That's going to have to be your next book.
Yeah.
Please work on that because I'm waiting for the answers here. I'm sorry, Jennifer. We are almost out of time. If people want to get a hold of your book, where do they go to find it?
So Beacon Press. If you just Google Beacon Press, you will the title of the book and Beacon Press. You can find it on Amazon. It is also distributed by Penguin Random House, and it is available hard copy, as Kindle, and also as an audiobook. And the audiobook is narrated by a disabled person. The cover is designed by a disabled person. I made almost every facet of it created by a disabled person.
Thank you so much for joining me today, Jennifer Natalia Fink, author of the book All Our Families, Disability Lineage, and the Future of Kinship. Thanks so much. This and other episodes of Disability Beat are available at weft.org/public affairs. For updates and information, join our Facebook page at Disability Beat Radio. To share ideas for guests or topics, email